Welcome to the Autism Roundtable. I'm Leah Gross, founder of Circle Care Services. I'll bring you autism experts from all kinds of fields for helpful parenting ideas, insights, and strategies. Tune in for learning and support and connection. Today, we have Dr. Jennifer Polis with us. And Dr. Polis, could you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, my name is Dr. Jennifer Polis. I am a pediatric psychologist here in Atlanta, Georgia. And I've had a private practice here since 2011. And my specialty is working with very young children, specifically 0 to 5 years of age, to help them obtain proper diagnosis and recommendations for the next steps of treatment. And thus far, I've been honored to assess over 8,000 kiddos. So I absolutely love what I do and hope that I can offer little bit of a glimpse into my life and how we can better help you guys.
Amazing. So, Dr. Polis, I thought because you have diagnosed so many children in the past, I know a lot of our listeners are parents of children with autism or exploring whether or not a child is on the autism spectrum. So I wanted to go through the steps of how I would know if I should get my child diagnosed, how I would know where to go and what to do. So even prior to booking an appointment, what things would a parent, caregiver have to know or have ahead of time before calling in? So I'm going to go first to the insurance side of things. Is this a covered service via insurance, or is this something that we get through the school system? How would a parent go about getting a diagnosis?
Yeah, it's a great question. So a lot of times people will say initially, hey, you know, I do see some developmental differences in my child, and they might approach their pediatrician or reach out immediately for early intervention services. Every state kind of has their early intervention here. It's Babies Can't Wait program. And then they will help you to facilitate getting a proper evaluation. And so when parents are kind of faced initially with noting these differences, it can be really scary because often, what are we told? Every child develops differently. Don't compare them to one another. But then again, if we never had a comparison, we would never know if we need help in any area. So I know it can be so difficult. And yes, everybody does develop at their own time. But if in your heart of hearts, you are seeing that there are differences, and it doesn't mean that's wrong, but it might just be different from the norm, then to reach out to the pediatrician. You may need a referral from your insurance company to get to the next step of evaluation, but typically you do not. Every insurance is so very different. Every state is different. Every provider is a little bit different. But me personally, a parent does not necessarily have to have a referral to get into the door. But sometimes people do go and get a referral from their pediatrician.
So that's a really great piece of information, because a lot of times moms tell me, like, I asked my pediatrician and the pediatrician said not to be worried yet, but really mom's feeling very much so like something's off here. So if a mom is feeling like something's off, which type of doctor or what type of professional would be appropriate to bring a child to if I was seeing things that might be a little bit different than, say, another one of my children or my children's peers? Which type of doctor would I look for?
So I would then encourage them to reach out to a pediatric psychologist or clinical psychologist, overall somebody who specializes in early development, and you can specifically look at their specialties. And if it says developmental delays, autism, those are some really, you know, great pointers to look for. Of course, with any profession, you know, you hear the word doctor and it's like, okay, well, there's a lot of specialties. So, you know, not every psychologist will work with this age group. It is quite a particular age group for this early intervention. Like I said, I specifically, my passion is 0 to 5 years of age. But you may call around and they might be like, oh, we don't start seeing children until they're 3 or 5 or 6 years of age. It doesn't mean that the person's not out there. It might just be a little bit harder to find. And we can diagnose and we can test children very, very young, actually, all the way down to 16 days of age is the youngest that I have. Our measures can go that young. And of course, those are for very, very particular reasons and the NICU and things. But other than that, there are specialists out there. So looking for that term clinical psychologist, that is the person who would be able to technically diagnose any, you know, developmental delay or autism spectrum disorder.
Right. And as an occupational therapist, what I definitely see is that children that are diagnosed earlier and do get the intervention earlier, we do see that they take to the therapy so much faster. Would you agree?
Absolutely. It's, you know, you hear so much that early intervention is key, and it absolutely is. It can make all the difference in the world.
So for people that have heard like, oh, wait till your child's 5, 6, 7 before going for an autism diagnosis, would you agree with that statement?
I would encourage them to do it much earlier because we just don't want to miss out on those very, very critical years of development. And so much can be learned with that time frame, and especially with the plethora of services out there now, even before kiddos get into that more traditional education setting. If they do have a diagnosis and we can get them into these, you know, more traditional therapies like speech and OT and ABA, oh my goodness, sometimes when they are ready to go into the classroom, they are absolutely ready and they're ahead of their peers on some things because they've been practicing this and they've been having fun doing it with learning.
With learning, and they each have a different learning method, and sort of maybe that has already been solved or cracked open or the child has learned to be a good learner at that point. So that's very hopeful. And that's something that's amazing for parents if they're able to get, you know, the services that it really does remediate. And it really helps these children to be able to be learners to the best of their capacity, of their abilities. Okay, so now back to how I would go about getting the diagnosis. I know from different clients of mine that getting a second opinion could be really tricky because insurance will cover the first evaluation, but they sometimes will give a really rough time about a second evaluation. So if I was going to find the first provider, like, you know, I want it to be covered by insurance. So what like sort of criterion would you recommend that I get in my first provider? Like, what am I looking for when I go on the web? It's a big wide web out there, and I'm searching a diagnostician for autism in my area or developmental delay in my area. When I'm calling the office, like what kind of things should I be looking out for?
Yes. And this is where it can get so challenging because you feel like you almost have to be a little bit of a mini pro in this area to even make an appointment. And it's like, it's almost not fair. But there are so many different types of evaluations out there. So when you call around, you can ask specifically if the center, the doctor, the practice is looking at a variety of different diagnoses, or are they just looking for autism? What types of testing do they do based on age? That can vary. So some of the types of testing that I include in each of my evaluations are cognitive testing, which later on would be equate to an IQ testing. We also look at visual motor integration, fine and gross motor skills, sensory, expressive and receptive language, adaptive and daily living skills. a whole host of different emotions and behavior transitions, and we are trying to gain information from multiple environments. So the child's home, the school, if at all possible, or therapies, and then of course within our practice when the child comes in for the evaluation. So that is, you know, the host that I am looking at, but then other practices, they might just strictly do autism testing. So when a parent may go for autism testing and they might get a report that says, okay, you know, the test came back and the clinician said that my child doesn't have autism, but I now don't have any further answers. I just know they don't have autism, but what do they have? Because I know that there's still delays. So then we get in that tough situation where if the insurance credits were used and we don't have any more, then that's where a parent might have to pay out of pocket or do something very brief to get further answers. So I would encourage you, if you are, maybe you're a very well-educated parent, you might have another child with autism, and you absolutely know that this baby has autism, hey, then maybe an autism center would be fine for just saying yes or no on autism. But if you are kind of conflicted with multiple different areas of development and want a more comprehensive evaluation, I would definitely inquire about what all will be looked at and what is the plethora of diagnoses that would be assessed for.
And like, how long should a comprehensive assessment be booked for? So when I call up and they say, okay, it's a half hour session, that might be a red flag, right? So like, what amount of time would a comprehensive session look like, evaluation look like?
Absolutely. So, and every practice does this a little bit differently. Some places do everything in one day. They might actually have the family come in. They may do a full clinical interview. Then they might have the child on the other side of the room or in another room doing their assessment while the parents are filling out paperwork. And then they may break for lunch and come back and deliver a diagnosis to the parents that same day. That could take, you know, several hours. That's not the way that I do it. I kind of do it over a span of about 2 to 4 weeks, over 3 sessions. So my first session with the parents is an hour long interview. This is information gathering, the story of your child. So really this is where I'm kind of walking you through the story of their life, birth and milestones, sleeping, eating, home life, early education, any intervention, family history, likes and dislikes. So really diving in and getting a little snapshot of this kiddo. And so to prepare for that session, you know, a lot of times if you'll get the paperwork ahead of time so you can kind of start filling that out, grab that baby book and start looking through those milestones, or, you know, thank goodness for some of the social media and pictures on our phones, because that's when most parents are like, when did they start crawling? And they can start, you know, flip back through pictures. So, you know, getting those dates in your head and being able to talk about your child's development. Then after that first interview, I may have to obtain the test authorization from insurance. This can be kind of a laborious process depending on the insurance, of going back and forth and fighting for your kiddo to get those testing credits. But then we set up, you know, the actual in-person testing appointment, and that could be as early as maybe the next day or within the next couple weeks. And that's when you come in the office, and every kiddo is different, of course, based on their developmental awareness and, you know, of course, their verbal skills. That if the child is non-speaking, you know, then of course, a lot of those verbal tasks are going to go very quickly. So we might not need as much time, and an evaluation might last an hour, hour and a half, but then they can last up to 3 hours long. You can also have evaluations over several days if needed. I always go with the child's interest and engagement. Some days we're just not feeling it, you know? It might be a tough day and we would never want to push a child beyond their limits. and get inaccurate data. So I'm, you know, very quick to say if we're not having a good day, we can always come back
and reschedule
for a different day because we want the best of the kiddo. And then from there, that is when a lot more of the background work happens. So a lot of times parents are like, well, you know, I want any impressions right now or the diagnosis. I want that report right now. Well, specifically with my practice, we put so much of our heart into these reports, and it honestly takes about another 15 to 20 hours of work on our part of scoring and interpreting and case conferences and piecing together the story of this child and if there is any specific profile or diagnosis and recommendations. So then all of that is delivered to the parents a couple weeks after the in-person session. And we go through the diagnosis, what it means, all the recommendations, resources, referrals, and then all of that's emailed in a huge email with lots of attachments so they're ready to go to the next steps.
Wow. Wow. Amazing. So now I know this, your process sounds so amazing, and I think every provider should give that amount of time, but I know not all providers are giving that amount of time. So when I'm looking for a provider, what maybe keywords or key gold standard tests should I be listening out for that would maybe tell me, yes, this doctor is really good? Or now another big one is like telehealth these days, where people are going on to a Zoom conference and getting a diagnosis or not getting a diagnosis, and then disappointed and using up their insurance credits for that. So what can I be listening out for to know, okay, yeah, this is going to be something that's going to truly give me some direction and answer?
Yes. So specifically in the state of Georgia right now, we know that insurance is requiring very specific test measures to be given in order to be granted the next step of service. So one of the biggest things is two different measures of autism. So a clinician rated measure and a parent rated measure. We do need both of those. So we do see a lot of the times maybe a clinician who doesn't accept insurance, they might not, you know, they're not required to necessarily know what is needed for those next steps, and they might be practicing within their scope, and that's absolutely fine. That's in their right. But if somebody does want to use insurance to get to the next steps of treatment, we do have to make sure that we have certain things there. So definitely making sure that there's at least two different assessments of autism given, a parent measure and a clinician measure. One of the gold standards of autism testing is the ADOS, the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule. This is a wonderful test replicated throughout the world in multiple languages, toys and activities to match different cultures. It's absolutely wonderful. And so this is a very popular test that is often given, but this is also one of those tests that give an autism score of, you know, are we on the spectrum or not on the spectrum per se? And it doesn't offer any additional information of like, this is a cognitive score, this is a language score, this is a motor score. So great test for autism specifically. Other tests that are absolutely wonderful and kind of hit other areas of development would be the Bayley Scales of Infant and Toddler Development. That's one of my favorites because that one goes from 16 days of age up to 43 months of age. So beautiful test to look at cognitive, speech and language, fine and gross motor. And then also a little bit for older kiddos, the Wechsler Scale IQ test. And so that really helps to hone in on the different parts of cognition. And we know that everybody learns differently, so that can give people a really great glimpse into how their child is processing cognitive information. And so those are some of the, you know, the major ones. And then there's a lot of supplemental tests. So especially if you are also seeking any further resources from your state, like SSI benefits, or if you have a private insurance but know that your kiddo is going to need a lot of different services, you can apply for the Katie Beckett Deeming Waiver, which is a state-funded program that allows Medicaid secondary to a private insurance for families who might make over the cutoff for traditional Medicaid. So the kiddo can be dual insured and save the family on a lot of those copays and deductibles. But then programs like that require very specific testing. So for that, you would need a cognitive measure. You would need the parent measure for autism, the clinician measure for autism, and a developmental and adaptive score measure. So you would have to make sure that the provider is giving an adaptive behavior measure too. So lots of different breakdowns and, you know, trying to piece that all together, which that's what I'm like, it's hard because you have to be a little expert before you're making an appointment.
Yeah. And you know what? That's exactly why I wanted to have this podcast, because I do feel like it's overwhelming. It's hard to know, and you kind of don't want to go in the wrong direction, and you don't want to get incorrect answers. Another big piece I'd love to bring up is, you know, some parents are really hesitant to put a label on their child, and it's very emotionally difficult. Stigmas stop them from being willing to get their children help. What kind of mind frame or advice can you possibly give to a parent that is really hesitant to move forward based on emotional or stigma reasons that are stopping them from moving forward with exploring a diagnosis for their child that they notice is delayed?
Sure. And that's, you know, that's one of the biggest areas that it's the hard, what some of the hardest calls that you ever have to make is to say, I think I need help in this domain. And that can be, you know, a huge step right there just to reach out for services. And it can then be so very discouraging, because as soon as somebody maybe makes peace with that and says, I do want help, then it's often all these wait lists and everything to even get the services. But if I would just encourage any parent that is tracking, you know, their child and seeing maybe some of these differences with emotions and behavior and developmental milestones, to just know that every child has a specific profile out there. And no matter what child it is, you know, when they are born into this world, we place so much emphasis on hopes and dreams for that child. But those are our hopes and dreams. And sometimes those change over time, and that's absolutely fine. You know, we can all think back of what we wanted to be when we grew up and how many times we've changed that. And that's okay if that changes for your child too. And it's not to say that, you know, maybe your hopes and dreams are gone at all. That's definitely not it, but they might have to be altered and given some additional help in these areas so they can achieve that. And truly, when we live in this world that it does seem like everything has a diagnosis or, you know, something to it, it can be very disheartening, because it does seem like, why do we have to label everything? But to know that ultimately you're giving your child a gift by saying, this is my child's profile. This is how my child views the world and learns. And by giving this diagnostic impression, it helps everybody around the child to understand how they learn and get them the services that they so greatly need. Because without that, we can't have access to these different therapies. Otherwise, you know, insurance would be looking at us going, well, there's nothing there. So how are we supposed to pay for something that is, you know, is not being stated to us?
Wow. Amazing. Thank you. And another thought I have is, like, a lot of times with the little ones, which I know is your specialty, parents will, like you kind of said, in their heart of hearts, they know that there's a little something off here. And it's kind of, it kind of feels like if I push it under the carpet or if I pretend it's not there, like in your clinical opinion, just like letting children develop and not tapping into it, how often do we see that works?
And I see most times that the parent then comes back, and when I ask them initially, when did you first start having questions or concerns about your child, they will say around that year mark or 18 months or 2 years, or when other people were encouraging and the teachers were saying something or the pediatrician encouraged a diagnosis, and they will then say, I was in denial. And then there's a lot of turmoil that occurs with them, you know, that internal struggle of, I should have reached out, I shouldn't have allowed my emotions to get the best of me. And now, you know, maybe their child wasn't able to obtain those services over the last several years. And I always say, though, you know, we're never too late with things. We, of course, went through and are still going through the challenge with COVID, and the fact that, you know, a lot of kiddos were on wait list. Their turn was up, and then boom, what happened? You know, the world shut down. And even once things started getting back to normal, it's still then other places weren't open. We weren't getting the services. So we're still seeing the ramifications of that and the delay in diagnosis because of that backlog. But, you know, it's, you know, nobody has that, you know, they don't pop out of the womb with an instruction book of this. No. Is how you're going to raise me.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Helpful, but, you know, so I would just, you know, say I'd encourage you to speak with others. Of course, the internet, like we're saying, that good old World Wide Web, it can be a very wonderful tool. It can also give you a lot of misinformation. So to reach out, to look at some valuable and trusted resources, to talk to friends, to speak to teachers, and, you know, they are with your kiddo, you know, each day, and they do get to see a different level of their engagement with others. So sometimes parents will get a little upset when they're like, well, they never do this at home. Well, home isn't school. So maybe they are seeing something that's different, and it's not meant to, you know, to harm in any certain way, but hopefully the teacher's really trying to give some additional guidance on, you know, how they're performing in a different environment.
Right. And I think as parents, we have to be receptive to what we're hearing, because as a provider, you know, it is a little scary to bring up red flags to a parent and say, hey, I'm really concerned. Like, you know, usually when they're by me, they already knew that there's something, a sensory processing issue, but then when we suspect that there's more than that and we need to make a recommendation to go get, you know, further evaluated or diagnosed, it's a scary thing for us as providers too, that we should say it in the right way and have a breakthrough in the right way, so that the parents are accepting and willing and not insulted. But I do think it's important for parents to hear and to listen, and to, you know, explore. It doesn't mean that you're making a stamp of anything. It's just you need that information to give your child the best. So that's really important. Now, who would have to know about the diagnosis if my child got a diagnosis? So say I'm willing to go get a diagnosis, but I really don't want the world to know about it. If you, Dr. Polis, gives a child a diagnosis, who besides for you has to know about that diagnosis?
So if you are using insurance, that would automatically allow insurance to know what the diagnosis would be in case of any audit or the billing code. So that would be, you know, shared with the insurance company. A lot of times, unless there is an audit of the chart, we're not traditionally sending in, you know, the full reports with the history per se, but we do have to bill for something of why somebody is coming in. So, you know, that would be noted within the insurance profile. And so really the only way to steer clear and own your information outright is to do private pay. Then if there is a diagnosis, you know, whatever way that it goes, that is your information, but the only way that a child would be able to obtain any additional services, whether it be more of the traditional therapies of speech, occupational, physical therapy, feeding therapy, ABA therapy, that report would be needed, would be shared with those companies and often sent to insurance companies as well for approval of services. Then I always do encourage families to share the information with the school, because there are tons of different resources that the school can offer, but again, they won't be able to offer them unless they have something in writing. So in my reports, I, you know, give pages and pages of recommendations. So a lot of times the schools themselves will just lift my recommendations straight out of the report and put them into an IEP for the child, an individualized education program. Or if it's going to a private school, you know, they have a bunch of resources there too. So I, you know, it's definitely your information. But then if any additional services are needed, that report is so critical to share with the other providers in the child's life so they can get a better glimpse of who they are and how they learn.
Okay, amazing. Now, for those parents that are super hesitant and are really feeling like giving my child a diagnosis is the end of the world, like what things can a parent, how could they emotionally prepare themselves? We all want to do the best for our children. So really they know, or in their heart of hearts, they want to go for this diagnosis so that, like you just said, the school could help them and get all those recommendations that you're talking about that will help their child to, you know, be the best version of themselves. How could we emotionally prepare for such a situation?
Yeah. So, and that can be the hardest thing, right? You know, to of course reach out to admit that there might be something that we need some additional help on, but to truly pull back and say, you know, this is all for the child. This is truly a gift and an acknowledgement stating that every child does learn differently. This isn't something that labels them as wrong or broken or needing to be fixed, because it's not. It's truly describing how a child learns, how they process emotions, behavior, the sensory world, how they are able to communicate with the world around them. And so we are really just painting a child's profile and delivering that to people that are around the kids so we can give them the best foot forward. And a lot of times people will say, you know, I don't know why this happened, why it's happening to me, how it occurred, and, you know, why there's so much autism going on these days. And we can look back at our history. And a lot of times when parents are kind of evaluating their own family history, they might say, well, nobody in the family's been diagnosed. But when you start looking back, you might realize, you know, Aunt so-and-so or Uncle so-and-so or Grandma, Grandpa, maybe there were some similarities there, but we just were not, you know, as versed as diagnosing that. And we didn't have the different resources out there. So, you know, truly knowing that you're giving your child a gift by helping them to understand that profile is incredible. And then also, a lot of times people will think of any mental health diagnoses like autism, anxiety, depression, and they will kind of internalize that so much and think that there's a big stigma around it. And, you know, there is a stigma with everything right now. And it's, you know, it's all on how it's viewed, but it gives us the golden ticket to get the services. And I would always say too, you know, if your child was having, you know, an allergic reaction and you had to take them into the hospital and they had to get an EpiPen and they're allergic to peanuts, is that a shame? You know, no, not at all. That's a medical diagnosis. There's something we can do to help it. And it doesn't mean that if we ignore it, it's not there. It is there. And we want to acknowledge that, because if we do, we can help to fix it. And if we're seeing those differences in socialization and emotions and behavior and verbal skills and sensory processing, we acknowledge it, and then we can ask for help so we can get the next steps.
Amazing. And as a parent, would you if I am feeling bad about getting a diagnosis, if I'm not feeling good about it, if it's something that is really hard for me, am I alone in this, or do you see that often?
Absolutely. We see it every day. And I think that people will, what they are sometimes feeling in that moment of the date that the diagnosis is delivered. And then I talk to parents, gosh, sometimes even that next week or a month later or years later, and they look back and they're like, wow, that was probably one of the hardest days. And now they look at how much has changed. And, it's very fun when I get to see, the kiddos come back for reevaluation, and it is a completely different outlook on life. And, they're like, wow, remember when I was crying in your office and, we're walking through everything, and now, oh my gosh, they're doing this, this, and this, and we are just rocking and rolling. And then you have people that are very excited to finally have the answers because they feel just absolutely validated. They might have been searching for an answer. And it is wonderful when we can provide an answer and options for the next steps. So, a lot of times it's a very big mix of emotions, allowing yourself to go through all those emotions and maybe grieve some of those struggles that you, of course, know nobody wanted for their child, but then also celebrate every single success and start to look at your child's development differently. What do we hear all the time? Milestones, all these milestones, milestones, milestones. Well, I'm in the camp of we should celebrate inch stones. Doesn't have to be a milestone. And you know what? Those inch stones, those can all be champagne moments as well. So, everybody is so different on that trajectory. So it's just a different timeline for celebration.
Exactly. And each child has their own measuring stick and their own way of, where that milestone's supposed to be. And as parents, we want to help them, achieve the top of their measuring stick and get to the best place possible. But really to understand that each child, each individual, me, you, everyone, we each have our own capacity and our own ability. And we're not all cut out of the same piece of cloth. So really to understand that and internalize it, but at the same time to understand that feelings are okay and that we're normal when we get emotional about our kids. And
And to allow, to be able to feel that and to speak with people about it. And that's when, getting started with early intervention right there, you're going to just build this community of people to love your child with you and support. And so I can't even count how many awesome little friendships have developed right in my waiting room. I mean, it's so cool to see the kiddos. And of course, myself and my staff, we're not out there going, hi, this is this person, that's HIPAA violation. But parents talk. They look at, they're seeing the kids play together. They're seeing their child engage with another friend out, there. And that's how those connections are made. And so it's wonderful to see that. It's great to join different support groups. I encourage people, of course, maybe Facebook often has a lot of support groups for different counties and cities for parents. So that is wonderful. But somebody that, you can reach out and share those tears of joy, sadness, frustration, every day is not going to be a bed of roses. So it's, you know, it's great to have people that you can lean on and who understand, you know, a little bit about what you're going through.
You're not alone in this, like you said.
You're not.
I'm sure you have the statistics, but what are the statistics now for autism?
You know, and that's the thing. There are so many different markers on that. Some people and some research basis are saying 1 in 36, 1 in 42, 1 in 50. Everybody has a little bit different measure, but, you know, we know that coming from even 10 years ago when it was, you know, very few out of 100 to sometimes, you know, about 1 in 50, that's a lot. It is interesting to see how our world is changing. It's also amazing to see the accommodations and the understanding of neurodiversity in our world. Many people present those questions of, well, how could this impact my child getting a job in the future? How would this be viewed? And what's amazing is there are some companies out there now that are reaching out specifically for people that have a diagnosis on the spectrum to have them work for their company. So
yeah. I was just hearing about different programs through the state and through the government where they are incentivizing companies to hire people with neurodivergent diagnoses and they're providing jobs and then it's wonderful for everyone because the work's getting done and then we have people employed that are really being successful. So there is really nice programs out there that are being developed, and I do feel like everyone is tapping in and understanding that we do have a big community out there and that we need to provide for them, and we have to set up a world that does include our children and our adults with autism individuals. Okay, so now I want to go back to your recommendations. So after I get a diagnosis, so we talked about the assessment process where you're doing different assessments over 3 days, and then you take the time to write a 15 to 20 hour report. God bless you, and then you hand that to the parent, and in there is a list of recommendations. What kind of recommendations can you? What sort of recommendations are you giving to a parent that when I leave your office, I'm going into the world with this new diagnosis, and what do I do now? So what should I be expecting there?
Yeah, so everybody, of course, does very array of different diagnoses, or different recommendations per the diagnosis. I tend to be very verbose in giving people a lot of information because I understand that often we won't be able to reevaluate this child for another 2 to 3 years based on insurance requirements and, you know, just assessing for change. So even though maybe the child is only 2.5 years old and we're not yet in school, I'm going to put in the school recommendations because in 6 months to a year, they might need those. So a lot of the recommendations will include referrals for the different therapies if needed. So speech, occupational, physical, feeding, hippotherapy, aquatherapy, art therapy, all of those different options. I would include the school recommendations, resources, and websites and books for the family members, siblings, even the child themselves to learn about their diagnosis, if that's something that, you know, we're a time frame that we're at. I also offer things for the home environment with regard to structuring the home environment, different activities that you can do with your child right from the beginning to increase development. I always provide some developmental checklists from the CDC to just make sure we're keeping track of them. And then a lot of times families will also often say that, oh, you know, we have other kids in the house and maybe, you know, we should be tracking little brother or little sister. So just kind of helping them to assess that. I also like to give information on scholarships, the special needs scholarship fund, any scholarship organizations, schools that work with kiddos with neurodivergence. And just any additional resources for the school setting, like how to prepare an IEP and different books, resources for that. And then as well as the next steps for helping to cover treatment costs. So whether that is if the family qualifies for SSI income supportive services through the state, or if they could qualify for that Katie Beckett deeming waiver program, if they have private insurance and they could get a Medicaid secondary to that. So kind of setting up a whole host of different options for them within the next steps. But then as we end that call, it can be incredibly overwhelming to have these, you know, 13 attachments and 30-page report and going, well, where do I start right now? And typically, that is when we back up and say, let's start with the basics. Let's get our therapies honed in. Sometimes they already maybe have like speech or occupational therapy. But one of the biggest things that we want to get started is ABA. And so I always provide a referral for them and a huge chart containing probably over 100 different places around the state, because I do work to see people from all over the state, so they can reach out and start getting some resources, beginning with the therapies. And then the second half is to look at those insurance benefits of applying for any SSI, the additional insurance and financial coverage, or the Katie Beckett. So those are the two biggest pieces of information for the homework.
The homework. And on your 0-3 population, most kids are coming in already in early intervention, or at that point you're making the recommendation for early intervention?
Yeah, I would say probably about 70% have kind of started into at least one of the therapies or into the Babies Can't Wait program. Just because typically people are able to get into one of the early intervention therapies first before they're able to get a full psych eval.
Okay. And then following, so 0-3, some children are starting ABA even as little as like, I don't know, we've seen from 12 months and on, but yeah. Up until 3, they are eligible for early intervention, where they do get the OT, the PT, the speech, and the DI, or the teacher. And then after 3, that's when they're going to go into the school system or an ABA system, where they'll be able to be helped either like in the home, in a clinic, or in a school setting. Is there any like specific recommendations that you would give to parents to look out for when getting therapy, or how to get the therapy, or is that very individualized based on each child and their needs?
Yeah, it is very, very individualized. There are so many options out there, which that again can, you know, just be so overwhelming. So do we do a combination of speech and OT and ABA? Do we focus just on ABA? Do we do split ABA and school? And it's like, oh my goodness, all these different options. So that is where I do have some parent resources. I do work specifically with one wonderful provider who she actually is a doctor of psychology herself and now a mama of a kiddo with autism. So instead of going the more traditional route of getting licensed and being a clinical psychologist and doing what I'm doing, she developed a consultation practice where she actually roadmaps and blueprints out a pathway for a family. So where I write up that whole report, then a parent can hire her to sit down and go through everything and kind of map that out and say, well, based on your child's specific strengths and you and your husband's schedule, this is the place that would just be the jam for you guys. And so that's amazing. That can be an option. There are a lot of different parent support groups out there, so you can kind of walk through and see what other people do. And then just speaking with each provider, each ABA company, and seeing what those options are. Is it a full-time program where they're in the clinic? Do they come out to the home? Because maybe we don't have transportation to get there every day. How are we going to be most consistent with services? So it is highly, highly individualized.
Right. And a lot of times I tell parents, follow your instincts. Like if you're not feeling like you like a provider, you don't have to stay there. Just move on and get to the next one. There are so many amazing providers out there that you have to be a good match with the provider, and your child also has to be a good match with the provider, because it's important for it to be a team approach where you're getting the support that you need in order to support your child and that you're feeling comfortable, because as parents, we do have good instincts. There's a reason we fail them, you know?
Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
The next question I have for you, Dr. Polis, is when do you see these children again? So after you gave them that page of recommendations and they go find their therapy and they start exploring the world with their new diagnosis, when will you see a client again? Are you seeing them often, or are you seeing them at intervals? Are you seeing them only when they reach out? When should a parent reach out? So what does that look like?
Yeah. So with anything, you know, my practice has kind of changed over time. I used to be able to hold more of like a follow-up and therapy caseload, but specifically because, as if you're in the middle of this process, you know that sometimes these wait lists are, you know, a year long, or any, you know, it's very, very frustrating. So I have shifted to doing just psychological testing in my practice and the reevaluation process. So reevaluations are typically conducted every 2 to 3 years. This is kind of an ever-changing, change with the insurance. We go with the flow with what they want and what is, you know, required. So we, you know, whatever they are needing to make sure that our kiddos can stay in the therapies is what we will do. So I developed a specific track for any kiddo that already has a diagnosis of autism, but is just needing that reevaluation. And for those kiddos, I do see of all ages for children, not just my babies 0 to 5. So if you do have a diagnosis of autism, it's a couple years past, your ABA therapist is saying, oh, we need an updated evaluation. People can call in and they're able to get an appointment more so within a few weeks rather than having to call back beyond different lists. And this is a shorter evaluation. We are kind of breaking it down, looking at some brief cognitive, emotional, behavioral, daily living skills. But it's super fun because now we get to see the growth that the child has made or those areas that we are still wanting to work on. We can reassess to see what level they're at. A lot of people too, I'd love to mention with the levels, because people will often get very, very bogged down with the levels of autism. And there's a lot of misinformation out there, and there's different ways that the school does levels versus how we do levels from the psych perspective. So the levels of
autism. Can I stop? Yeah. Can I ask a little bit more about the levels of autism? That's such.
So yes, the levels of autism, they're first and foremost, when we make the diagnosis, the term autism spectrum disorder, that is the biggest thing. That is the take home message. And that is part of you. That's great. It's just describing a part of how your profile is. Then everything else that comes after those words can change over time. First and foremost, the first area that we look at as a clinician is saying, is it autism with or without a language disorder associated? So sure, a lot of people come in and they will have a language impairment. So, you know, it might be autism with a language impairment. Then the next area that we're looking at is cognitive impairment, if there is one. So is it autism with or without an intellectual or cognitive impairment? So of course, when we're super, super young, we're not going to throw an IQ on a child, but we might have some baseline information of their cognition and problem solving. But most of those times we're saying we need to come back and revisit that when they're older to see about any intellectual difference. Then we have the levels of autism, level one, level two, level three. And we're trying to better understand the level of support that is needed for a child with their restricted repetitive behaviors and with their social communication. And so you can have different levels there. A lot of people think that this means mild, moderate, and severe, level one, level two, level three. And that is not the case. It is truly to describe the level of service that is required for the child based on their current symptoms and where they're at. So it's not saying anything about your child and being severe autism versus mild autism. We have people that might have incredibly high IQs and super, super high functioning, but they need a lot of support to get through their day. So they might have a higher level of service, and that's okay. And the levels will change. So level one, that's more characteristic of somebody who is utilizing full back and forth speech patterns. They're talking in paragraphs. They can get through their day without a lot of additional support. They might have been level three, but they have their coping skills and they're able to get through the day without a lot of support. Level two, that might be somebody who is able to use some basics of verbal and nonverbal communication. They're making those gains in certain areas, but still need a very substantial level of support. Maybe they need that speech and ABA and occupational therapy. Then level three, that's a lot of times where, you know, when we're starting out with anything, a lot of times we want the most. We want the biggest, the baddest, the best. And the highest level of service hours. So that might be a kiddo who is pre-verbal or non-verbal, or, you know, maybe not very communicative. They might have more of those traditional areas of the spectrum that we're trying to work on and getting the biggest amount of global help. So those are kind of a breakdown of the levels, and those will change over time. So wow. And people wow. will joke around that they can change by, sometimes people will be like, they change by the day, you know, we all, but don't we all, you know, there are some days when it's like, whoa, we needed a lot more support today. And then we don't maybe need as much the next day. Every day is going to be different, but that's truly a really great guide for insurance and clinicians to know what level of care we need.
And then you mentioned that the school system has a different level of, okay. So for an insurance provider, it's one, two, and three. And that is really just saying how much support each child should be eligible based on the doctor's recommendation. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
And then how does the school system work? Do you know?
Yeah. So the school is a whole separate domain that I will not even say that I'm incredibly well versed in, since that is, you know, not my specialty. But we, you know, reading through multiple IEPs, seeing the differences from county to county, even state to state, the way that autism is represented in the school system can greatly vary. So, for example, we have a lot of kiddos that come in that have a full diagnosis of autism, but in their IEP eligibility, they're rated under significant developmental delay or speech language delay, and it doesn't even say autism. Then we have people that actually get an eligibility criteria of autism in the school system, and they don't yet have a clinical diagnosis from a doctor. A lot of people then will call and say, my child has a diagnosis of autism. The school made it. And that is typically, I won't say 100% not true, but most of the time they are talking about a classification that their child falls in for the school system, but that is not a medical or psychological diagnosis. The only people that can make that would be a clinical psychologist or a developmental pediatrician. Typically, the wonderful people working within the school system, they are working for those school requirements. So I had a family come in a couple days ago that mom was saying the school is reversed with the levels. So her child, she wanted her child to move to a level three class because she is making so many gains. So The level one class was the highest support service for the kiddos, where the level three class was the least restrictive environment. So I'm like, oh man, of course it has to be different for everybody. But yeah, so that is the school. That's a whole separate challenge. But I always refer people, especially to educational consultants, people to help you with that process to make sure that your kiddo is getting everything they deserve in the school system.
Yeah, and it is important to acknowledge that the spectrum is very wide, and each child on the spectrum has their own place on it. And yes, you are with others and you're in a community, but your child is most definitely individual, and a number is not gonna suffice to label who your child is. He comes with, or she comes with, like so many other wonderful things. And we have to remember that it's not a diagnosis, it's an individual. And it's important for us to, as parents, as caregivers, to always remember that. Okay, so thank you so much. You were such a wealth of knowledge. I enjoyed this podcast so much with you.
Thank you.
If I was going to ask you for one last message to give to our listeners, something that they can walk away with today after getting all this knowledge, what would it be?
So I always like to end with, you know, each of my conversations is, of course, when we are talking about all of these differences maybe that a child is going through, we always want to step back and go, what do you love most about your child? What is your child excelling at? What just makes your day? And so to remember those highlights and those amazing strengths that your child has, and that your child is not a diagnosis. And we are definitely striving for any sort of excellence, but we're not striving for perfection. Nobody is perfect out there. And, you know, excellence can come in so many forms. And every child's brain is so uniquely beautiful. And just to really take it upon yourself to say, this is a gift. It is, you know, something that we are going to celebrate each day. Other, you know, some days might be a little more challenging than others. Others might be absolutely incredible. But to know that you are giving your child a gift by helping to look into them in the way that they learn and providing them with those resources, and to celebrate every success that is made. And just to know that every child is so uniquely dynamic and wonderful, and people learn in different ways, and that is okay. And what is represented in these psychological evaluations of these scores and seeing deficits and things that are extremely low in developmental delays, that is not your child. Your child is amazing. And that was just a platform to get us the services so we can watch them grow and gain and be everything they can be.
Thank you, Dr. Polis. That was wonderful. Thank you for your kind words and your wealth of knowledge, really.
Oh, thank you.
I'm sure our listeners are going to really enjoy. So
thank you.